Hello, everyone. I'm Kevin Gastola, and welcome to another edition of the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast. I'm very pleased to be joined for this week's show by Mickey Huff, who is a director of Project Censored, and also Andy Lee Roth, who is the associate director for Project Censored. And they're here to discuss the yearbook that they do annually, the State of the Free Press 2024. It covers media democracy, examines news media trends from the past year, has censored stories, and we're going to get to all of that during our discussion today. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having us, Kevin.
If memory serves me correctly, Rania and myself, we put together a contribution to one of the prior yearbooks that looked at unauthorized disclosure and what we were trying to do with podcasting, creating a space for media democracy. And so it's good to have you and to discuss what you've been focused on as maybe defining the last 12 to 18 months, as these yearbooks are retrospectives that help people prepare for where the media landscape is headed. One of the things you look at in particular, and this is for Andy or Mickey, you dive into the absence of journalism from many Americans' lives and how there is this law happening, these news deserts that people are finding, in particular, the loss of local media organizations. Could I get both of you to dive into this pressing crisis that has developed in our media?
Yeah. Kevin, thanks for that question. And I'll take maybe what you could think of as the supply side of the question, and Mickey can maybe handle the demand side. On the supply side, as it were, we know that news deserts are an increasing problem across the United States. There are, according to a 2022 report issued by Northwestern on local news, the state of local news, now about one-fifth of all Americans, which would be 70 million people, live in counties where there is only one local newspaper or there are no local newspapers. And those are, in effect, the defining terms of what is counted as a news desert. It's important to add to that figure, the sheer numbers are incredible. When there's a dearth of local news, we know from past Project Censored underreported stories that that's the vacuum into which so-called pink slime journalism moves in to take advantage of the hunger, the need for local news, and monetizes that need and floods that vacuum with disinformation and misinformation. That's one hazard of news deserts. The other compounding factor when it comes to news deserts, so the problem of the lack of supply of trustworthy news, is that many of these counties that are qualify as news deserts are also counties characterized by a low income socioeconomic status, which means there's also what Project Censored has covered in the past as the digital divide or digital redlining. These are communities without internet access in many cases, or without affordable internet access, which means they're doubly cut off from any kind of news or public affairs content due to both the one-two combo of a lack of a local newspaper and a lack of digital access. And we know from studies like the Northwestern annual report that these news deserts are highly associated with the public being misinformed or disinformed, yawning gaps, the kind of bipartisan divide that is hamstringing politics in the country right now, and a host of other social problems. So that would be on the supply side of the dearth of trustworthy local news, news deserts.
Yeah, and on the demand side, as we write in the introduction to the book, we talk about the challenges of divided attention. For years, we've talked about the proliferation of sensational news and junk food news. And this year, we bring in this concept of news snacking. which is, you know, similar to some things that we've discussed before, but this is more specific and actually relates to a colleague of ours, Hector Harkotter from the German News Enlightenment that we also work with. And they talk about news snacking. In other words, it's this idea that, and I'll to quote, it says, it's discarded news. News is no longer received consciously, but rather consumed incidentally like potato chips. Meaning news kind of finds us. Our devices tell us when there's a news alert, or somehow if there's something important happening, we have this assumption that in our digital media ecosystem that the important things will come right at me, because that's the efficiency of big tech and so on. And you know, what we discovered, of course, is that just feeds people's confirmation bias. It leaves massive gaps in their knowledge and context about world events. Exacerbated by the problem of news deserts, it likely means they have maybe next to no knowledge or information about what's going on in their backyard, at their city council, at their school board, in their own communities. And so, you know, the demand side of this challenge, I guess you could argue, Kevin, is us. What are our news habits? And this is why Andy and I continue to and have long argued for critical media literacy education. We can teach, and we have been at Project Censored since 1976, before that was even a phrase or a term, critical media literacy. We've been teaching people how to understand the news, how to think critically about it, how to find trustworthy independent sources. But it's work, you know, it requires some work and it requires time and effort. And there's a lot of noise in that digital space and in the news media landscape. And so I think, and again, I'm biased here, but I do think that Project Censored as an organization goes a long way to try to help give people tools to sort out how and where they get their information. We're in the business of trying to help people think critically about that news and diversify that news diet. We're not in the business of trying to tell people tell people this is the truth or this source is factual and this one is not. Because once you start really analyzing the news and looking at the outlets, because you are paying attention, you're not news snacking, you're deliberately ordering from that menu, you're going to want to expand it and find as many different sources as you can to make sure that you're getting the most information that's accurate, that's available to get about things that are happening.
That's very good. And so you put forward the idea that one of the solutions or something that could help us guide our way out of the crisis would be to turn to the tradition of muckraking journalism that has existed, and to look towards those journalists that defined what it meant to be a muckraker. You write that it could be a model of how journalism might be renewed. The book describes it could be successful in part because it would harness a public appetite for shame and scandal to the cause of political engagement. I mean, you're paraphrasing a scholar with that quote. Why don't you discuss why you feel like this is a potential remedy?
Well, so, you know, there's a long tradition of muckraking, truth-telling journalism in our country, and it's pretty lively. If you go back and look, you know, over 100 years ago, the kind of stories that Ida Mae Tarbell was telling, I mean, Ida Mae Tarbell is largely responsible for the ultimate breakup and takedown of Rockefeller and Standard Oil. No small feat in that day. Lincoln Steffens did a whole series of, and this is the key term, what were popular investigative articles. At the turn of the century in the so-called progressive era, there was a taste in the public to find out about this. It wasn't just gossip or, you know, some kind of tawdry scandal. It was actually learning about the kind of corruption. Steffens talked about unholy alliances between city councils and town hall and, right, the political spectrum and the business spectrum, right? And, you know, Steffens was doing studies all across the country. He started at the Shame of Cities in St. Louis, went to Pittsburgh, other places. And what he discovered is this kind of corruption was going on all over. What's the point of this? Muckraking journalists connect the dots. They tell people what's really going on so that they can be meaningfully civically engaged. We have a long tradition of this. And guess what happened to some of these muckrakers? Upton Sinclair. They percolated all the way up to the level of the White House that caused Teddy Roosevelt to begin regulating safety in the meatpacking industry. So journalism can really make a difference. But what else happened, Kevin? is the popularity of this appealed to the business model of journalism. And so a lot of the papers at the time started putting out penny press, yellow journalism, sensational stories that weren't well researched, that actually led to a decline in the kind of muckraking journalism. And what Andy and I argue, and what we've been doing at Project Censored for decades, really, is reminding the public that that tradition didn't go away. It just gets crowded out by an exceedingly commercial news media landscape. So we think that we don't need to, you know, reinvent per se, as much as we maybe need to imagine and highlight. Like, if you go through chapter one of our book every year, those are perfect examples of people that we think are intrepid muckraking journalists that are telling the public what's really going on. And we think that that's significant. And those kinds of changes in the media landscape are related to the ways in which people develop their news habits. In other words, if we can help teach people how to seek out these kinds of journalists, maybe we'd have a more accurately informed public.
Mm-hmm. And Andy, if you wanted to add, that's fine, but let me put to you something that I think has some synergy with the Censored Yearbook, and get into the figure of Elon Musk over the last year and a half, simply because I think he fits into trends that you've examined regularly. On one hand, you have this celebrity tech person, tech mogul, I guess, if you want to call him that, who has left quite an imprint on the news over the last year and a half. Then there's the media's obsession with him as a figure. I think sometimes maybe giving him more importance than he deserves. But you also have Musk's own obsession, his narcissistic addiction with social media and being in the news headlines. And that gives us plenty of junk food news. So I put that out there for our conversation.
Thanks, Kevin. That's a very juicy question. On Musk himself, I think, you know, the first thing I think to know about Musk is that he's a media oligarch, not news. The second thing is that, of course, he fancies himself a free speech advocate, but his long-term track record, going back long before he was the owner of Twitter X, it runs contrary to that self-assessment. There's a clear record of him being interested in suppressing freedom of expression that's only been amplified by his acquisition and then, I don't know what we call it, management or mismanagement of Twitter. But I want to step away from personalities and individuals and address, I think, a larger issue that your question raises in terms of the state of the free press in the United States in 2024, or as we head into 2024, which is the outsized and very dangerous, in my opinion, role of these social media giants, these big tech giants, in effect, becoming what I've referred to in other articles of mine as the new gatekeepers. And that image of gatekeeping goes back to the earliest studies in the sociology of news and journalism, when intrepid sociologists went and hung out with the editors of newspapers as wire stories came in, and they watched the decision-making processes of the editors to decide that they would run this story and not this story, and the reasons why. And the early studies referred to those people as gatekeepers, the idea that they're controlling what comes through or what is blocked at the gate. The new gatekeepers now are digital tech platforms and social platforms like Twitter, like Facebook, increasingly things like TikTok. And the actual gatekeepers aren't human beings in the role of editors, they are algorithms. And those algorithms are in effect black boxed because they're considered proprietary property of the companies. And so we have no public access to understand how they're operating. So you couldn't go in today as a sociologist interested in gatekeeping around news and actually study the YouTube algorithm because it's proprietary. You can study the effects of the algorithm indirectly, as Abram Anderson and I have done in terms of LGBTQ censorship, but you can't see the algorithm. The other point there that I would make is that these entities have no commitment to journalism, much less the ethical standards that, say, the Society of Professional Journalists advocates. So we now have gatekeeping being undertaken not by news professionals, but by algorithms that are created and operated in secret by tech platforms that aren't committed to journalistic integrity. And that's a serious problem for the state of the free press in our age now.
Anything you'd like to add, Mickey?
Well, Andy just said a mouthful. And honestly, in the last so many years, we've increasingly been turning our attention to this kind of censorship because it's pervasive. Yet prior restraint, right? That's what we look at when we see the government intervening to suppress information, right? That's where a lot of the case law goes. And as Andy suggested, there's little means by which for the public not only to know and understand how this kind of curation is happening at big tech, there seems to be no avenue toward accountability, because any of the cases that go forward, like he mentioned, they end up being decided on the basis in terms of business for the free market in the favor of big tech companies for proprietary arrangements, that they own this and we don't have the rights to it, even though these private companies now are basic de facto stand-ins for what would be the historical public square.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's mm-hmm. important just on that point to elaborate ever so much more. The court decisions that have been made have all determined that, say, Google or YouTube has no obligation to disclose the algorithm. But in the cases that I'm most familiar with, LGBTQ content creators on YouTube, the request, the class action suit wasn't saying make the algorithm public. It was, the claim was make the algorithm available to an independent third party for review. And even that level of oversight has been rejected repeatedly by courts. So there is a kind of corporate government interface here, insofar as the judicial system, in all the cases that I'm aware of, has sided with big tech when there have been challenges to try to expose biases that are baked into the algorithms that we're talking about.
It's kind of a farce in a sense, because of the way that people go about acting like these people who hold themselves out as free speech champions or that they care about the Constitution or promote democracy and human rights, and they fund these projects and they get involved with sometimes activist groups or nonprofits, and then at the same time they're engaged in censorship. It doesn't align. It doesn't, like, they can't be doing both at the same time. And also, as we saw with the Twitter files over the last year and a half from Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger, and some other journalists that partnered here and there, but mostly those two have been the spearhead. What we see is the way in which new FBI and other agencies have had their ability to go in there and make decisions about what content is censored, which to me, I think opens these companies up to actually being held accountable, because, you know, now you have government agencies that are playing a role in determining the censorship that takes place on these platforms. Mm-hmm.
I'll say something quickly, just linking us back one more bit on Twitter, and then we can talk about what Mickey and I and Avram Anderson have been writing about as censorship by proxy. But just on Twitter, Reporters Without Borders issued a press release earlier this week announcing, denouncing, X Twitter's claim that they, quote, support Reporters Without Borders. And the press release read, Reporters Without Borders setting the record straight. We do not receive any support whatsoever from the social network. Elon Musk's company is a haven for disinformation and in no way an ally to an organization defending journalism. So that's out there. Of course, it's harder to rebut a claim once it's made, but anyone who's seen those Twitter claims about Reporters Without Borders and Twitter's support for that important, crucial organization needs to be aware that Reporters Without Borders themselves have completely rejected those claims as spurious.
And even Matt Taibbi has exited the Twitter X platform recently because of issues there. And the main issue, of course, was their blocking of access to his Substack and his account and his writing. And again, I like Andy, take this away from Musk, because it's these personalities, these billionaires that suck all the air out of the room. And Andy and I wrote about that before last year's book. We were writing a lot about the billionaire press and a lot of these folks. We tend to focus more than structurally on what's wrong with that system, not what's wrong with Elon Musk, right? And by the way, the Twitter files, part of the Twitter files, a lot of that story got panned by the so-called liberal media because of the hatred of Musk. It kind of falls into the Trump zone where it's like anything that involves those people no longer has any kind of like actual reporting about the subject they're discussing and turns into a screed about them. And that's problematic. So we focused on the actual story, and one of the top 25 stories lists from Matt Taibbi and another article from The Guardian, Kenan Malik, talks about what we found in the Twitter files. And it is government collusion. It is government interference. It is agency interference with censoring and curating narratives. It is problematic. There's evidence that the Biden administration has done it. They tried to create the Disinformation Governance Board and it failed, but who knows where it continues. That's another one of the top stories, Kevin, that we addressed. But maybe worse, again, it's not just Biden. We have evidence that this was happening in the Trump administration. We have historical documents going back about COINTELPRO and the FBI. We have documents. I don't know what the thumb is. I certainly don't approve of COINTELPRO and the FBI. But also
they were just giving that a thumbs up.
Yeah, the CIA, right. We're not approving.
Yeah.
We're certainly not approving of any of these things. But again, it gets difficult, Kevin, to talk about the subject of these stories because they get so overshadowed by the powerful personalities that drive media content to get eyeballs to advertisers. But when you peek behind the curtain, there's a lot of problems and there's a lot of the censorship by proxy that Andy mentioned.
I'm in complete agreement that we need to focus on the systems and the institutions and where the centers of power happen to lie. And because you have this culture within media organizations that are averse to challenging power for various reasons, which mm-hmm. I think you probably have spent countless Project Censored yearbooks touching upon this kind of initiative. But let me get to, I'm going to put a question to you. Just to move this along, one of the things that you highlight, which it happened a long time ago, people don't really remember, but it could come back at any moment. We could see this panic take place again. You work in a mention of the so-called Chinese spy balloons that we all felt were terrorizing us earlier, or we were told were terrorizing our airspace earlier this year. But then, you know, connected to that, as you mentioned it in the junk food news portion of the book, if I'm getting that correct, you also raise the coverage of UFOs that existed. And I'll just, because of my background, I'll work this in here, although I know it's maybe slightly outside of what was written in this chapter, but just for the sake of our conversation, there was this hearing on Capitol Hill with UFO whistleblowers. And it was remarkable because all of these people, I believe it was a House hearing, all of these representatives were taking these supposed whistleblowers seriously. And one of them, the leader, I actually thought had some very kooky and wild ideas about what the government had uncovered. And without very seriously interrogating what was being put forward and without even like exploring the ramifications of what this guy was suggesting, his name's David Grush, and he's suggesting that he would be endangered if he revealed more information, if he talked about these details. It made things very phony and kind of unhinged, in my opinion. But I suppose it also shows you why House representatives and others in the media would want to dive into this. It's very easy to go into this because there's no structures at all that are at risk, in my opinion, in talking about this. And especially now if the Pentagon's going to say that, like, we take these they actually renamed it. It's like, it's unidentified aerial something or other. It's like UAPs now instead of UFOs. But in any case, it's a distraction more than anything, because it's not getting to the core of what like the motivation for following and exploring UFOs has either been because of a potential extraterrestrial life that could come into our airspace, which I think is worthy of scientific exploration, but then also like the cover up of aerial machines that the government doesn't want us to know about that involves technology that maybe has not been disclosed.
Uh-huh. Well, Andy, do you want to talk about any of that? Or you want me to jump in?
I would just say very quickly, picking up on that last observation, Kevin, the United States weaponized drone program still gets very little coverage proportional to its impacts globally. But we aren't going to hear congressional hearings on those programs. We aren't going to hear about those for a variety of reasons that have to do with, one, Congress people lacking security clearances to talk publicly about those programs, and also military contractors' massive lobbying of those same elected representatives. So if we want to talk about things in the air that are potential threats, if not to us as citizens of the United States in a global context, you know, I guess I come back again and again to underreporting of something like that, which is systemic. And I mean that term carefully. It's systemic in the sense that there is a program that we know a little bit about because of some intrepid reporting, including reports occasionally from the New York Times, right? So not only independent investigative outlets, but also, you know, the Times, credit where credit is due on occasion. But instead we get, I think, something that with due respect to the concerns that were aired in those hearings, something that is to me ultimately a distraction.
Yeah. And Kevin, if you want to like do a top down order of it, the UFOs, and again, this is an interesting issue, but like you said, it's vague enough that it can be used for cover for nearly anything while simultaneously ignoring the identifiable flying objects that Andy just described that even have killed American citizens abroad. But in this case, we're talking about UFOs and obsession with that, and then the alleged hoax or the scare of the Chinese spy balloon that then turned into a weather balloon, that then turned into a hobbyist balloon, that we spent $500,000 with missiles shooting them down from F-22 fighters, spurring a near international incident, all at the same time, while real incidents are happening on Earth, like train derailments to the tune of 1,000 a year, like the one in East Palestine, Ohio, that was carrying toxic vinyl chloride that contaminated the area. It got very minor coverage. A reporter was attacked and arrested by police trying to cover it. That received little coverage. And then they had a massive burn off of the vinyl chloride to get rid of it so it didn't contaminate further. Mm-hmm. And again, all of this basically escapes coverage. Biden is running off to Ukraine. Buttigieg and the Transportation Department couldn't get there for like 2 weeks. Meanwhile, it's the Lever that's reporting that this happens 1,000 times. The New York Times eventually got around to talking about it, to their credit. But it's the Lever that was the one talking about the labor. And guess what else, Kevin? Railway workers were going to strike the previous year because of railway safety issues, among other issues. And the Democratic Biden administration intervened to prevent the strike. And one of the things they were striking about was Civil War era braking equipment, like the one on the Norfolk Southern Railway that failed, that caused the East Palestine train disaster. So we could have media that is fascinated with things right down here on Earth, where we can actually do something about them. And if they are interested in things in the skies, There's plenty of identifiable issues that Andy mentioned that we could be focusing on that don't involve ET.
All right, I want to wind down this portion for people who are just watching the free edition of the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast. Although first, I'd like to acknowledge the contribution from somebody who's been supportive of my work, and I was glad to see them included in the yearbook, and that's the Reporters Without Borders campaigns director, Rebecca Vincent, who has details. And if you pick up a copy of State of the Free Press 2024 from Project Censored, which you can find on their website, you will see just how stunning it has been for the organization to try and navigate getting access to the extradition proceedings, being able to also meet Julian Assange in Belmarsh prison and observe how he's being treated in that facility. And then also someone who I was able to link up with when I did a book event, Maximilian Alvarez, the Real News editor-in-chief there. He has a contribution, and he writes about doing long-form, sprawling, even meandering interviews. So, you know, this show has done countless meandering, long-form, sprawling interviews, and I'm quite a fan of those, and I think we need spaces for that. It doesn't always need to be these little YouTube, I guess they're calling them YouTube shorts now, or the little TikTok clips that people share. Oh, and it occurs to me before we wrap and move on to the subscriber portion that this is the first time I've been together with you since my book was published. And so I want to let everybody know that this is Mickey and Andy, and they helped me to make Guilty of Journalism, the Political Case Against Julian Assange, a reality. And I'm really grateful that they were willing to work on that book with me over the last year and a half.
We're such fans of that book, Kevin, and I think it embodies everything that motivated us to start the Censored Press in the first place. The idea of bringing forward stories that are against the grain of the mainstream, sometimes hegemonic narrative. And I think Guilty of Journalism checks all the boxes.
Yeah, it was an honor to work with you on that book, Kevin, Guilty of Journalism. One of the, not only most important, but one of the few books about the case against Assange. Very important, very timely, and we were honored to have a small part in it.
And get a copy of Project Censored's yearbook on their website. And so now we'll continue with the portion for subscribers.